just after 9 o'clock on a Saturday morning, and that must mean it's time again for Money Management with Opus 111 Group's Mike Mayo. Here's Mike.
Hello, good morning. Welcome to the latest installment of Money Management. We are your antidote to conventional wisdom. My name is Mike Mayo. I'm with the Opus 111 Group, and we're all set for another hour of bringing you financial news, a recap on what's been going on in our economic world, and most importantly, some insights into how it all affects you. Now, we had a busy news week, but as far as market movements are concerned, basically week over week, the markets have done very little. When you look at the major market indicators, they're basically just fractions up or down from where they were a week ago Friday. So let me tell you where the market closed yesterday. The Dow was down a whole 8 points at 33,300. S&P closed the week at 4,124. The NASDAQ ended at 12,284. Russell 2000 at 1739. Gold settled at $2,012 an ounce, silver at $23.92 an ounce. U.S. crude was last traded at $70.04 a barrel. 10-year Treasury ticked up a bit to 3.46%, and soft white wheat was quoted at $7.21 a bushel. Now, next Tuesday, we get our retail sales report out, and then also the industrial production report. Wednesday, housing starts. Thursday, existing home sales and like that. So pretty quiet week next week for news. Nothing of substance. There'll still be a few more earnings reports, but not too many. And then in terms of some of the news that was out about different companies this week, a good announcement from Boeing. Ryanair says they're going to be buying 150 737 of the MAX 10 planes with options for 150 more. Now, that's a lot of airplanes. It's Boeing's largest deal for new planes as the airlines are starting to replace their aging jets and, well, quite frankly, expand their fleets. The MAX 10 hasn't been certified by regulators, but it's a bigger 737 than what is out there right now. Apple, this is just kind of mind-boggling on one hand. Their current market capitalization is $2.7 trillion. That's one company. It's bigger than all 595 companies that are listed in the UK, bigger than all the companies in France. There's 235 companies there. I don't know if I mentioned, but 595 companies in the UK. And all 1,242 companies in India. Apple itself is twice the size of Germany's entire stock market. They have 255 companies. And part of it is because these, high values are being given to companies that are, well, of course, successful and growth-oriented. Germany's stock market, for example, is primarily value kinds of stocks, so they don't get the kind of play that the techs do here in the U.S. And Toyota, which is now the world's largest car maker by revenue, looks like they're going to be pulling in $22 billion in operating profit this fiscal year. So I would guess that you'll still be seeing Toyota out on the streets for a while. So anyway, what I wanted to do this week is kind of do some attitude adjusting. I just can't get over how negative everybody is. That's obviously a very broad brush, but a whole lot of folks are regarding the market, the economy, those kinds of things over which I have some knowledge. And it's just amazing to me, the negativity about it. It's not without reason, he added. But let's start with this debt ceiling limit, whatever. I like a term, but debt-mageddon, I can't even say it. instead of Armageddon, Debtmageddon. You know, there's like this big, oh my goodness, the world is ending. You know, I like this word, the concern, quote unquote, around debt ceiling negotiations have persisted. Just yesterday, they were supposed to have a meeting with the congressional leaders and the administration, but it's postponed till next week. So the way I look at it, they can't be too worried about it if they were able to kick it forward. You know, and just to kind of put all this in perspective, just going back to 1960, the debt limit has either been extended or revised 78 times. This is not a new thing. You know, the way that the media is beating it up, it's like, oh my goodness, look, this is a, look at this. We've never had this situation. That's because they don't remember the last time. But 78 times just since 1960, and it has always been moved higher. So what's the difference between the steady markets and all the gloom and doom coming from the administration and D.C. and beyond? Well, the simplest explanation is that the markets don't believe that Congress is, what's a polite word, foolish enough to default. You know, no matter how specific and how nasty the partisan threats are during previous debt ceiling showdowns, the bills always got paid, and for good reason. We, the U.S., is the most creditworthy borrower on the planet. That's right now, today, we are that entity. And just, you know, to put this word into correct context, to default is the failure to make required interest or principal repayments on a debt. Now, debtors default because they're unable, not necessarily unwilling, to make payments. So markets must be signaling something different, namely that even if a default were to happen, it would be less damage than anticipated, if at all. You know, it's really hard to imagine us refusing to pay debts for long, or that such a delay would meaningfully curb public companies' profits or the company's ability to repay their own debts. You know, by that reason, there seems to be little need for the stock and bond markets to react. As for the U.S. Treasuries, they remain by far the world's safe haven no matter what happens. Not only because we have the biggest and most stable economy on the planet, it's also because the treasuries are the only store of value that global investors can agree on. Nobody else is even remotely in that conversation. Now, if a default were to churn the markets and cause asset prices to drop, as many, and this word is so overused, as many fear, where else could you safely park your money? See, the catch-22 is that cash in the bank is insured by the same government that's behind U.S. Treasuries. And deposits above the federally insured limit are, well, technically no safer, right? And moving money overseas wouldn't be any more desirable if all of a sudden the henny-penny world is ending school of economics panic spills beyond U.S. borders. Never mind that, for the most part, investors are reluctant to leave home in the best of times, wherever home may be. And whether or not markets are right to keep cool about the debt ceiling drama, fear of default is probably a greater risk to investors than default itself, kind of like a variation on the FDR. You know, the greatest thing we have to fear is fear itself. And that's right. Any decline in the markets is likely to be temporary. If you go back and look at the markets, yeah, we've had a few hiccups along the way, haven't we? Depressions, recessions, all that stuff. And those who ignore short-term volatility will continue to benefit from rising asset prices over time. On the other hand, if a default never materializes or turns out to have little or no effect, those who sell in fear now may hesitate to get back in at higher prices down the road, which makes their decision to sell out even more costly and emotionally difficult, as the markets tend to trend higher as they do historically. So let's not get too hung up in this debt ceiling thing. it's going to be in the news. It's something that the media can spell easily. But in my experience, 50 years of doing this, like I said, since 1960, they've had all those time, and it's always been revised up. By the way, if you miss any of our programs or parts of any of our programs, you can find the entire broadcast on our website at opus111group.com. And it'll be there typically about 2-3 days after the show goes live. Excuse me. And without commercial interruption. So if you'd like to do that, feel free. I'm going to touch on the inflation thing because we had a couple reports this past week. The Consumer Price Index and the Producer Price Index come out. And with regard to the Consumer Price Index, that measures inflation at our level, if you will. It was up in April, but the amount that rose was somewhat smaller than expected. It was up 4.9% year over year. It had been anticipated to be 5. Now, a tenth of a percent, you go, what? Well, but in this world, that's considered less. So optimism for the disinflation process, if you will, to continue is pretty high because the report showed that shelter prices, you know, rents, owner equivalent rents, they're called, and like that, they remain up, which just means the lag we're seeing with rent prices should start to meaningfully show up over the next few months. Now, Treasury yields dropped after the report because that further supporting a stock market which has been worried. That's another long with fear that is way overdone with regard to the market, in my occasionally humble opinion, but which has been worried about higher rates snuffing out economic growth. In other words, they're saying, well, Fed keeps raising rates, that'll put the brakes on a number of goods and services and companies around the country. Well, maybe not. So overall market gains, though, this week were contained because the cyclical stocks, those are the ones most likely to an closely linked to an economic recovery, did trade lower. Nike, Caterpillar were in the red because, again, some investors feel that inflation was slowing simply because a recession is imminent or the country was already in one. Now, I'm not sure how they come up with that, but that's their reasoning. You know, there is no, please note, there is no meaningful long-term relationship between stocks and the trends of inflation. I can attest to the fact, again, I've been doing this since 1973 and have seen a few different movies of this type. Stocks have done fine in periods of accelerating and slowing inflation alike. They've gone up alongside elevated inflation rates before. We've also had bear markets with fast and slow inflation. So we don't think slowing inflation at this point is some massively bullish driver. However, inflation fears were a major contributor to last year's bear market, along with the Fed U-turn and rate hike fears that they gave off. And as improvement from here kind of diminishes those fears, well, that could be a tailwind to some extent, although the effect would probably drop off as it gets more widely seen and, as they say, priced into the shares. Now, we don't think this hinges on the Fed pausing its rate hikes or even being able to cut soon, as so many were saying this past Wednesday. See, because that, too, gives too much market-moving power to the Fed and ignores that stocks have risen through several big rate hikes already. Moreover, markets have already priced in reduced Fed activity. In other words, you know, this pause they're talking about, not raising the rate by another 0.25% the next time and so on. You may recall that at this time last year, investors and our friends in the media were projecting several percentage points worth of hikes. Now those kinds of expectations are minimal. So after successive percentage rate hikes, a 0.25% or more probably feels like a pause. And as for potential rate cuts, the conventional don't fight the Fed wisdom says those would be bullish. Now, the futures market expects 3 Fed rate cuts before the end of the year and another 5 next year. That's assuming they're all 0.25%. Now, I don't know. That's just a whole bunch of cuts. But, you know, that's what the futures market said. And by the way, the futures market is made up of folks like thee and me deciding, what do I think the rates will be out there? So, again, it's just another kind of weather vane to give you some indication of what the general market is thinking. But consider also that if the Fed were to cut, the cast of, I think it's the usual suspects, the cast of perpetually fearful worriers would be in evidence again, saying that the central bankers see mounting economic risks. Many of them would probably point out that the Fed typically doesn't start cutting until well into a recession, and doing so during an expansion just because they can is a very rare thing. Besides, considering rate hikes haven't really slowed our economic growth, it seems illogical to say good times from here hinge on cuts. So here, too, we see room for sentiment to improve. It can only go up. I mean, it's like the old phrase, it's been down so long, it looks like up to me kind of thing. The inflation expectations angle also definitely indicates dug-in, deep-seated pessimism. The argument from those folks, while inflation may be slowing, expectations, which often become a self-fulfilling prophecy, are too high. Yeah, it's now trendy to view it as a psychological phenomena. If businesses think inflation will be high, they'll set prices accordingly. On the other hand, if consumers think inflation will be high, they'll pay higher prices. The next couple of months are going to provide, I think, an interesting test for the Fed as the outside increases in inflation that took place a year ago in May and June begin to roll off the year-over-year comparisons. That could make it look like inflation is, you know, dropping off rapidly. However, as is often the case, that surge in inflation last year was followed by a lull with inflation barely budging in July and August, again, of last year. So that means we're very likely to see the 12-month inflation readings pick up again toward the end of this summer. However, hopefully, Mr. Powell and his crew will look beyond the short-term volatility in the data and realize that the fight's not quite finished. Now, the producer price index, that measures inflation at the manufacturing level, what they call the wholesale prices, was up just 0.2% in April, also better than expected. And it showed that service sector led prices higher. About 80% of the rise was due to services. And good prices increased in April, higher costs for gas. But this was offset partially by a 38% drop in prices for chicken eggs. You remember you had to mortgage your house to buy a dozen eggs not too long ago? Well, as they say in this business, the cure for high prices is high prices. So getting back more into normal kinds of price ranges for that particular product. Prices even further back in the pipeline were a mixed bag. Prices for intermediate demand processed goods were lower, while unprocessed goods jumped up 1.7%. So the signs of easing pressure, that's positive. But it's clear, again, as I just said, we're not quite at the finish line yet. What's this gentleman's name? Ed Moya. He's senior market analyst at OANDA. OANDA? O-A-N-D-A. That's where he is. He said, and I'm quoting, "Wall Street didn't get any surprises from either the producer price index or the jobless claims," which, by the way, grew by 22,000 folks last week. The producer prices are expected to continue to decline as the supply chain normalizes, while rising jobless claims provide further evidence that the labor market is easing. That's according to Mr. Moya. So that kind of makes sense to me. And, you know, market expectations, almost always based on the recent past. They call it the recency bias. So when, you know, people are saying, well, the market was this, and now it's going to be that, based on what it just was. No, you got to look past that. Remember, the market anticipates, and these other reports, the inflation reports, the GDP, all of those are lagging indicators. It's stuff that's already happened. So you got to balance it out that way. And in this particular segment, I want to talk more about the market in general and to hopefully give some heart to those people who are concerned about the markets or the economy and just don't be so worried about it. I mean, first of all, there's nothing any of us can do about it, right? You can't control that. The only thing you control is your attitude. So, you know, let's kind of work on that and see if I can help give you some light at the end of the tunnel that's not the next train down the track. So if you look at the New York Stock Exchange, per se, there are 2,400 stocks that trade on that guy. Are listed there, more correctly. They don't all necessarily trade every day, but in any regard, that's the number. Now, according to J.C. Peretz, this man is a technical analyst. He does charts and graphs and all that other tea leaf reading and frog innards and all those other kinds of things to figure out which way the markets are going. But here's some data that I think is really, interesting. Of the 2,400 stocks, 819 of them, and this is as of yesterday, excuse me, this data is as of the 6th of May. So given the fact we didn't change much over the week, I'll go with these as being pretty accurate. So JC said 819 stocks are up 10% for the year. 531 are up 15%. 379 are up 20%. 196 up 30. 128 are up 40. 79 up 50. 36 up 75%, and 10 have already doubled. And these are just New York listed companies. I mean, others have gone up too, but that's what I mean by just. These are all quality companies. It's not just five stocks. It's not just Amazon and Facebook and all that stuff. This is a broad participation. These folks are all in the market and doing well. And, excuse me, so just on the surface of it, the broad market is not doing badly. Unfortunately, the tendency of the media, primarily financial media, is to pick out the yeah buts. You know, this went up, but, and that's got a good record, but, you know, and that's their kind of method of operation. And just yesterday, here's some stocks that are pretty close to all-time highs. O'Reilly Auto. Highest level since April of 93 when it first came to market. The Pulte Group, which is a they build homes, is what I'm trying to say. All-time high now since its IPO in 1972. General Mills, we all know General Mills. They're at all-time highs going back to 1928. Pepsi, all-time highs going back to when they merged with Frito-Lay. In 1965, and First Solar traded at levels yesterday not seen since 2008. Now, that's five stocks. What do they have in common? Nothing, other than their stocks. You know, auto is auto supplies, right? Rebuilding your car. Pulte Group, again, building home. General Moose. Must be a cow. General Moose. General Mills. You know, food, Pepsi, food and snacks, First Solar, solar energy. I mean, there's no connector there other than they're being bought because of their own fiscal situation. And yet, money managers, these are the folks who run the big money, the retirement funds, the trust accounts, all that kind of stuff. They're turning to the defensive stocks and treasuries because they're looking for, quote unquote, safe places to invest their cash. But they're also worried about missing out on a potential rally. They're kind of caught between a rock and a hard place. You got to understand that these cats, they get a report card every 3 months. And their compensation is pretty much tied to how they do every 3 months. So that's tough. That's a tough world to live in. And so, you know, when you're getting all these, you should be in this and out of that and go here and do that, you know, on the various financial programs and things that you might read. Most of them are oriented toward this kind of mentality, not toward investors. Okay, because many of today's investors, analysts, pundits, call them what you want, are of the glass half-empty school of perception. They seem to be always looking out for the catastrophic weeks left to live diagnosis for what, at least so far, has been a pretty mostly ordinary amount of market fluctuation. So is it fair to consider to call today's investors hypochondriacs? Well, you know, given their seemingly near hysterical levels of sentiment, I mean, and this is what I just don't understand. I mean, the general sentiment is worse than what it was in 1987 after our one-day sale. The dot-com implosion, 9/11, the 2008-2009. What is going on to cause that kind of distress? You know, here, consider this. On the good news, unemployment at 3.4%, 50-year lows. 50-year lows. You don't have a weak economy with 50-year low unemployment. Earnings continue to come in at or near record levels. There are still trillions of that fiscal stimulus money floating around, if you will, still stimulating the economy. Consumer spending remains near record highs. Major money center banks are very healthy. And the U.S. is the global leader in stock market value. $40 trillion in stock market wealth in the U.S. That's 60% of the value of all the stocks in the world. We got liquidity. Remember, that's why we got safety. People don't worry about their money. They know they'll get it back. Now, we're talking about bonds here. But so what are the negatives? Well, some regional banks continue to lose assets, which is kind of surprising because, you know, everybody, whether you work, whether you bank with Chase, the biggest bank, or whether it's mom and dad's bank down around the corner, they all have FDIC insurance. And if you can see a sign, it'll be posted. You can ask them, are my accounts insured by the FDIC? Yes. And if that's the case, you have $250,000 protected, no questions asked. So, why would you move it out if you don't gain anything by going to the larger bank for just insurance protection? That's something to think of. Inflation in the services area remains kind of sticky. Yeah, and again, many market participants still expect a recession. This dude has been coming for ever. It still isn't here yet, but it's always, you know, like the monster trying to catch up to you, it would appear. This debt ceiling brinksmanship continues to threaten stability, and they'll take it to the last who knows what, and both sides will point fingers and say it was the other guy that caused all this travail, and they'll both be wrong. And again, the markets are essentially flat over the last couple of years because of the uncertainty. So, do you think the market glass is half empty or half full? Here's kind of a exercise to allow you to operate without the hindsight bias getting in the way. Imagine you're hanging out at the end of last year, having at the New Year's Eve party, and an all-knowing market seer says to you that almost halfway through this year, this will be the case. Rates will be appreciably higher. Three of the biggest bank failures in history will occur. The U.S. will be considering the defaulting on its debt, and high-flying stocks will disappoint on earnings and see a substantial decline in price. So, now fess up. Given all that, if that's what you heard on January 1st, would you be bullish or bearish? The quiz question before the break was, are you bullish or bearish based on that outlook, which was someone had said The rates would be appreciably higher, 3 bank failures, the verge of defaulting on debt, high-flying stocks, some will disappoint on earnings, and so on. Now, if you said bullish, I think in terms of full disclosure, you might want to break out the fire extinguisher because your pants are likely on fire. You know what I'm saying? Liar, liar, and so on. As of yesterday, though, this is legit numbers. The S&P 500 is up year-to-date about 6.9%. The NASDAQ is up almost 17% over the same period. I mean, that's pretty good when you consider all this negative stuff we've been talking about, and which seems to be overlaying everything. And from FactSet, these guys are pretty good at coming up with data. The first quarter earnings season is, well, pretty much over. And for 85% of companies in the S&P that have reported results, that's 428 companies, 79% have topped their earnings estimates. That's above the 10-year average of 73%. Now, the average beat has been by about 7% above the 10-year average of 6.4%. Now, except for utilities, all the sectors have topped analyst estimates. This result tops pessimistic expectations overall. Now, in our view, the stocks dropped last year, likely pre-priced in this dip because, again, markets look ahead. And that's anticipating what could be coming next. Now, seeing the actual decline and how shallow it is, I think should help reduce uncertainty and help the stocks, the market, to move on. None of the sectors are making convincing moves in either direction, reflecting a general lack of conviction in the market. I mean, that's been pretty obvious. There's been no movement. I mean, even our total trading volume this last week was almost like mid-August doldrums time. Just the uncertainty is way high. Now, net profit margins, that's what's left after all the expenses, which is production costs, tax, interest, marketing, admin, overhead, all that stuff. So expenses as a percentage of sales, it was up to 11.5% in this quarter, well, in the first quarter, compared to 11.3% in the fourth quarter. Now, again, a small difference, but it's the first increase in 6 quarters. But something's always breaking. There's always something to worry about. You know, that's that wall of worry you hear about in the stock market. And, you know, there's always some issue on the edge of disaster, a la the debt-mageddon. And even good news can be problematic. Because when everything's going great, the stability, you know, makes you complacent. And maybe you get a little excess speculation and so on, you know. But think about it. If you've been a person who's been around, well, I'll give you the benefit of the doubt. I'll do it this way. From when I started in January, well, actually it was April of 73 through now, we've had 3 rather significant market crises. January to October, the S&P was down 73 to 74. The S&P was down 48%. From March 2000 to October 2002, the S&P down 49%. October 2007 to March 2009, S&P down 57%. Now, those are significant. There's no way to make light of that. But over these 50 years, the S&P has been up 35 times. That's the long view. That's why you don't react to the headlines. The cash dividend is up 21 times, with inflation being up only 7 times. So your cash flow alone has outperformed the consumer price index. The annual compound rate of total return, that's with reinvesting in dividends, of the S&P over 50 years was 10.2%. And that's despite having gone in half 3 times. Now, you can't time this. The only way you get it is to ride out the declines, however small or temporary they may be. You know, it's a good bet in economics that this is true. The past wasn't as good as you remember. The present isn't as bad as you think, and the future is going to be a lot better than what you anticipate. And again, yesterday, I think it was yesterday, maybe it was Thursday, I don't know, but the consumer sentiment readings from the University of Michigan, which come out monthly, showed that the consumer sentiment deteriorated again. You know, and here's this one sentence that I thought kind of laid it all out, and I'm quoting, while current incoming macroeconomic data show no sign of recession, consumer worries about the economy escalated in May alongside the proliferation of negative news about the economy, including the debt crisis standoff. In other words, the economy is pretty good shape, but the tone of the news is giving you the perception that things are bad. No wonder you're confused. And yeah, actually the economy is doing pretty well. Perhaps the most obvious sign the economy is in good shape is, as I alluded to earlier, the strong labor market. And just last week, we got confirmation that employers continue to add hundreds of thousands of jobs per month, and the unemployment rate at a 50-year low. Come on. Jeepers. In April, the unemployment rate, lowest level since 1969. And it all makes sense when you think about it. More hiring means more people have more money. And when more people have more money, there's more spending. And when there's more spending, businesses are growing. And for businesses to grow, they need to do more hiring. See, the stock prices can move day to day, minute to minute. But what the companies do doesn't move that quickly. That's why you invest in good, solid businesses, which will continue to be there over time. You know, if consumers have money, I think it's kind of axiomatic that they'll spend it regardless of how negative sentiment may be. You know, there's a counterintuitive trend that continues to help reinforce economic growth to this day. And even as the economic activity can cool, most measures continue to hold up. And all of this is to say that the economy consumers are actually experiencing is much stronger than the economy that they think they're pursuing. So why are they so unhappy? Hard to explain. You know, again, I think what the University of Michigan folks said to the proliferation of negative news about the economy is a definitely major contributing factor. When you got all that blasting in your ear 24/7, I mean, crikey. What else can you do? You're not involved in this stuff every day like we are. Yeah, it can be quite distressing. You know, beware those alarming business stories that get a lot of news coverage. You know, like the one that when they were all excited about how much coverage, well, they weren't all excited, but all the coverage that was given to the layoffs in the tech industry, which really is only about that industry as a whole, is only about 3% of employment. So the amount of folks that they were laying off, of course, if you're one of them, well, that's a different story. But in terms of just the hard data, no meaningful figure. So what we've learned about over the past several months is despite the tech layoffs, employment in the overall economy continues to do well. You know, it's been my experience over my career that bad news gets a lot more attention than good news. And, you know, as the data suggests, people are interested in good news, or bad news, excuse me. You know, I don't know if last October's low will mark the start of the stocks bull market recovery, but it certainly looks like it is. And that wall of worry remains for markets to climb, so you got plenty of room for reality to exceed expectations and still send stocks higher. So, improve your attitudes. It's not that bad. Just don't get all caught up in the daily headlines. You know, don't jump just because some headline changed. And in closing, most importantly, happy Mother's Day to all the folks who are mothers, and let me include all the folks who have ever had a mother. So that's everybody. So thank you very much for listening. We'll be back next week, hopefully with more positive economic and market news. You've been listening to Money Management. I'm Mike Mayo with the Opus 111 Group.
Join us again next Saturday morning at this same time for the financial insight, opinion, and perspective of Money Management with Opus 111's Mike Mayo. Have a question or comment? Email us at info@opus111group.com or visit our website, opus111group.com. Sections of this radio show contain forward-looking statements that are not guarantees of future performance. This information is from sources we believe to be reliable. However, we cannot guarantee that it is accurate or complete. These comments are for informational purposes only and should not be construed as investment advice, nor as a recommendation to buy or sell any security or investment product mentioned in this show. Investing involves risks, and past performance is not indicative of future results. Individual circumstances do vary. Please consult an investment professional prior to making any investment decisions.